Survival Math, Notes on an All-American Family, is author and Oregonian Mitchell S. Jackson's memoir of growing up in struggling family and community circumstances in Portland, Oregon. The day-to-day calculations of how to survive within the challenging circumstances of race, class, economics, and the crack epidemic of the 80s and 90s loom large over Jackson's memoir, but the work is also an unflinching look at personal choice-making and the chance to use the steadfast tool of the writer and artist, revision, as a metaphor to change one's life after poor choice-making, regardless of the challenges of family history or systemic bias. Jackson crafts expansive, multifaceted responses to four questions. Who are we? What have we learned? What have we endured? And how do we proceed? What emerges is a portrait of a family, a community, and a nation that still needs to reckon with its own history. Mitchell S. Jackson and Survival Math, Notes on an All-American Family, today on the Keenest Observers. Born in Portland, Oregon, Mitchell S. Jackson is a writer and clinical associate professor of writing and liberal studies at New York University. His debut novel, The Residue Years, received wide critical praise. Jackson is the winner of a Whiting Award. His novel also won the Ernest J. Gaines Prize for Literary Excellence and was a finalist for the Center for Fiction Flannery Dunham First Novel Prize, the P.E.N. Hemingway Award for Debut Fiction, and the Hurston Wright Legacy Award. Jackson's honors include fellowships from the Lannan Foundation, the Ford Foundation, Pan America, TED, the New York Foundation for the Arts, and the Center for Fiction. His writing has appeared or is forthcoming in the New Yorker, Harper's, the New York Times, Book Review, The Paris Review, The Guardian, Tin House, and elsewhere. Mitchell S. Jackson, thanks and welcome to the Keenest Observers.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Most definitely, most definitely. First, in this first block of time, tell me about the title. Why Survival Math? What does that mean? And why Notes on an All-American Family?
Okay. So survival math comes from me reflecting on an incident that happened in my early 20s, back when I was selling drugs and living in Northeast Portland. And the incident that preempted it was someone tried to basically rob me. It was a home invasion. They tried to kick in the back door of my the house that I was living in with my then partner. And luckily, my neighbor yelled out the window that he was going to call the police and scared him off. And so because I grew up in Portland and was kind of connected to the kind of criminalized enterprises, I went and talked to the, you know, one of my kind of mentors, and he told me who it was. So a few months later, I was coming out of the house of a friend very early in the morning, maybe 6 in the morning, and I saw a guy pedaling on a bicycle, and he, it was the guy that had tried to break into my house, which I didn't know until he kind of got up on me, and he jumped off his bike, and he said, "I heard you were looking for me," and at the time, I had a gun on me, but it was in my car, and I couldn't find my keys, and so I'm just standing there, you know, unarmed. And he pulls out his pistol and he points it at me and he was like, "Are you looking for me?" And I look one way down the street, I look another way down the street. I realize it's very early in the morning, there are no witnesses. I kind of consider, what is his reputation, what I know of it, is he likely to shoot me? If he does, is he going to aim for the head or the stomach or the leg? All of these kind of considerations. You know, if I let him go, should I get in my car and kind of drive and shoot him and get away? Well, if I don't kill him, are they going to arrest me? So these, I don't know, myriad considerations happen, it would seem like, in just a few seconds or a second. And later when I was reflecting on that, I christened that, those calculations, survival math. So the kind of simple definition is survival math is the calculus that one must exact when faced with a mortal threat. The All-American in the title comes from me really wanting to emphasize this idea that though we are often kind of marginalized and othered, that these stories are All-American, that they are born out of circumstances that were created by this country.
Yeah, I think that's what's very interesting. I love that survival math is the calculus and the immediate calculus that happens when in dire circumstances. And, you know, if I recall correctly, you knew this guy to some degree.
Yeah.
He was a classmate.
And so you also, worse.
Exactly. So you're calculating relationship and all of those myriad factors in an immediate close set of time in order to decide how to survive.
Yes.
And then that, you know, that it's more American than we know. These circumstances and the that you outline in the book are far more American than maybe the general public tends to give credence to. And I want to get to that because structurally you start this book up, especially in the prologue, giving a very strong historical frame.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the story in the prologue with Marcus and how you link that to American history and Oregonian history and then consequently the Portland of your rearing and growing to manhood?
Yeah, probably midway through writing the manuscript, I discovered the story of Marcus Lopez, who was the first person of African descent on record to step foot in what became Oregon, so when it was a territory. And he was killed by some natives the first day that he arrived in Oregon.
You know what, Mitchell,
Oregon.
Can you hold there for a quick second?
No problem.
I think we're going to hit a break.
Okay.
That I didn't see, and I want to pick up right there.
Okay.
We're definitely talking to Mitchell S. Jackson and his book, Survival Math, Notes on an All-American Family. Drop this March. Stay with us and engage. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Robert Goodwin, and we're talking to author Mitchell S. Jackson about his book, Survival Math, Notes on an All-American Family. You're welcome to join the conversation. Call us at 800-838-3760 or email comments and questions to jx@jeffnet.org. And if you're wondering why I might sound a little odd, I am on the phone, and we're doing this remote through the magic of digital technology, which is why I cut you off. Mitchell, from the story, I missed the break. So can you tell me more about Marcus and his being the first recorded African-American on the soil in Oregon? We were picking up there.
Yeah. So he was, I just thought it was symbolic that the first African that landed on the future Oregon was killed. And then later I learned that he actually was killed on my birthday. Killed on. Yeah, so he was August 16th, and I was August 16th, born on August 16th. So it really felt fitting to me. And I also thought that symbolically what happened to him kind of heralded the kind of fraught relationship with people of color in Oregon from then on. And I was really interested in establishing the historical framework for the kind of intimate stories that I would tell later on in the book. So the opening of the book is a letter to him about what's transpired in this place since his death.
Right, literally, you know, and I can't believe I missed that those your birth and his death.
Yeah.
I went right past that, that just makes the whole letter that you set up, which is literally, you know, for the audience, a literal history from what would be Marcus's time, you know, from being from Cape Verde and moving through history all the way to your, like, prime time rearing, you know. You really set the space and the downbeat for what would then be an exploration of your family dynamic, you know, and how that relates to, you know, American dynamic with people of color, and vice versa, and what it takes to survive in, you know, in America in neighborhoods.
Yeah.
That leads me to even more, you know, kind of, you know, questions about, you know, structure. One, I'll be very frank. I didn't know that the Portland, Oregon of your time and rearing was as rough as it was in your time, man.
Yeah.
And I think you set that up in the very first section. But before we talk about that. You set this up in four sections,
yes.
and you have we in every one of them.
Yes.
What have we learned? What have we endured? How do we proceed? Mm. Who is the we, and why did you structure it this way?
You know, I think the we, there's kind of different pronouns that I'm using for different effects. So the survival files are written in the second person, and I did that because I wanted people to imagine themselves as the person involved in whatever the conflict was, but then also I think they work as a first person, so they're dynamic. And I think in the those are Cento poems that the Cento poems are poems that are created from the lines of other poets. And in this case, I created Cento's from historic American documents, so Declaration of Independence, Gettysburg Address, Bill of Rights. And I really wanted to kind of take these venerated American texts and then use their language to frame my personal stories or the personal stories about my family. And also, it kind of goes back to what's an all-American story, so I'm really trying to, again, frame these in the context of American history. But the we shifts, right? So, like, what have we endured? To me, it's like, what have my people endured? What have we learned could also be what have, you know, my people learned, but then what also has America learned in our kind of, you know, long history of oppression of people of color and marginalized groups. So it kind of shifts, and I really want the reader to ask, am I a part of the we? And then what part of their identity makes them believe themselves a part of the we, or what part of their identity makes them excludes them from being the we in any given case.
Right. And again, audience, the brilliance of Mitchell's book is that pretty much in every chapter, there is a concept that is either that we know as majority-based or sometimes even European-based. You reference a lot of Greek and Roman etymology, and then you connect it back to the hood.
Right.
Or your family, you know, connection. Like, so, I mean, if you want to get an idea of macro to micro political theory all the way to what you may not understand about, you know, social constructs and challenges within, you know, neighborhoods in our country, this is a great read because, you know, for instance, you know, the Mitzrayim, you know, concept in the beginning that talks about, like, literally that word, you know, is talking about getting out of a tight spot. And so you use that to frame how you got out of a tight spot right before grad school.
Yeah.
When you got caught up, you know, with some of your people that you used to rock with, you know, and I thought that was brilliant. Like, wow, you know, so what is, how do you get out of a tight spot to your exodus?
Yeah.
You know, in order to, like, you know, go to become who you're going to be, which is also another part of that word, which is becoming.
Right.
Which is,
yeah.
I mean, again, brilliant, you know. So we probably need to give some more context about this. So help me out in terms of, like, the meta structure in this, and in order for maybe the audience to give an idea about how you were trying to work through these levels.
Yeah, so the first thing is the book opens with a letter to Marcus. So it's a letter to the past about the present, but then it closes with a letter to my daughter, which I imagined as a letter to the future. So those are kind of the bookends of it, which I really value recursiveness in books, really in stories as well. Then there, it's broken into four parts. Each of them begin with the Cento poem, right? So trying to frame the stories that follow, the essays that follow in American history. And then also kind of taking what they have told us are these kind of great words, and then showing the hypocrisy and the irony in these words and how they have been, you know, used to almost bludgeon people of color in certain instances. And then there are 12 essays. Each of them, again, yeah, they're connected to an idea. So, you know, there's American Blood, where I talk about, you know, the people who are, you know, poor in this country might be the most patriotic because they have to maintain this sense of, you know, nationalism and patriotism while the country is not holding them up and taking care of them. There's my matrimony with my mother's long-term addiction and me kind of trying to figure out a way to make peace with it and, you know, coming up with the idea that maybe it was a long-term marriage and that she was being committed. So there, each of them I did try to ground in an idea, but I was always trying to move from the personal to kind of contextualize each one of those ideas in social or cultural or history.
Right. So if we got to the next level of that, how you do that is by not only the essays that are based in your experience, but also these second person
survivor files. Yes.
So can you tell us about survivor files and how they connect to the structure you just outlaid?
Yes. So the cover features 16 men. All of them are from my family. And because I had already had my kind of the concept of survival math, I wanted to investigate who in my family had similar situations or just really what they had overcome. And so I took photos of them, and I actually decontextualized the photos. So I shot them all the same. I had them wear a black T-shirt. I told them to take off all their jewelry because I also want viewers to look at the images without any kind of context cues. And then I ask each man the same question: what's the toughest thing you survived? And then I write their answers to that question as a second person narrative. So the survival files are the second person survival stories of the men in my family, and they run with the images. But the caveat is that I never mention which story belongs to which man. I want the reader to try to make those connections and then to investigate what is it about these men that they see that makes them believe a particular story belongs to a particular person.
And so in between the survivor files, we get to learn about you, your experience, and your experience with your family.
Yes.
And so I found this really, really dynamic. And of course, as a Black man with a lot of resonance, you know, from community and folks who walk comparable walks, you know, family has its own challenge. But again, you set this idea of like the composite father,
yeah,
you know, as a downbeat because, and that becomes, you know, going along with your mother's addiction, really, it seems like it, you know, impressed upon you in terms of who you would become. Can you talk about that as well?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think all my life I heard about the dangers of single parent homes and what the long-term detriments were for children that grew up in them. And I don't doubt that, you know, two-parent homes are advantageous, but I also figured, you know, they're not, sadly, these are still happening. And so I was really trying to figure out, like, what's the workaround for that? And one of the things that I thought about were all the men in my life who had really served as exemplars to me. And so I came up with this idea that that if you don't have a singular, if you don't have a father, either biological or not, that you need to develop a father figure and that you can do that by pulling examples from men in your life. I think it's very hard for me to imagine a circumstance in which a young person would not have anyone who served as a kind of father figure, whether it was a coach or a teacher or a cousin or an uncle or a grandfather. And so I think the trick is to figure out what it is about that person that you want to emulate. So I think you also have to kind of learn things about yourself, and maybe some of the things that you end up emulating you figure out are harmful to you or not qualities that you want, in which case you got to kind of set those aside. But I think, you know, the further along you get, the more you kind of establish your values and your goals, you can kind of build a composite of what you need. And so that was me trying to turn what was a weakness into a strength. I had a writing teacher that used to say, turn your meagerness into a muchness. And so Composite Pops is one of those things.
And so Composite Pops for you, and again, I'm talking to Mitchell S. Jackson, I should say your name and your book, Survivor Math, Notes on an All-American Family. Your Composite Pops then became your grandfather.
Yes.
Who had an interesting history, you know, connected to your mother. Is that the I'm on the right line?
Yeah, right. That's right.
Okay. Yeah. And you know, had a matricide, you know, he ended up murdering your grandmother, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. And, murder, I don't know about if I would use that word, but yes, she ended up.
Okay. Help me out, cuz you know, I think that's what was interesting about that part of the book to me, because you never know what goes on and what then in family, and then what impresses upon the next generation.
Right. Yeah.
Because I don't want to say it for you. You know, you could speak more, you know, clearly to that than I could. But I, as a reader, you know, seeing the line of your mother being at five, right, being the
right,
person who found her mother.
Yeah.
You know, that impressed upon her. She said, I checked out your documentary from the novel, your previous novel.
Okay, yeah.
And she said, yeah, she says, I was a mother from the time I was five.
Yeah.
You know, and that's powerful.
Right.
You know, and yeah. And so as you talk about the Composite Pops, you know, and how that kind of related, you know, and how that kind of impressed upon you, you know, what was interesting to me when you start pulling out that ecology is that you see all of the effects, and then consequently, you know, what you're writing on about on the macro, right, coming to bear. So we should break that down. So the Composite Pops was your grandfather, and
grandfather,
then Big
Chris. He was, I consider him like my father, because he was there from the time I was one until he died, which was maybe 10 years ago now. And him and my mother, they had their difficulties in a partnership, but he also he never distinguished between me and his biological children, and I really admired that about him. You know, the older that I got, I realized his kind of some of his personal failings, but I could never dismiss how he had taken me in. And so, yeah, he's one of them. Then I have an uncle who was like, you know, the kind of sports hero when he was in high school, and imbued me with that kind of courage and belief in myself. And then my biological father, my mother went to prison for a little while, and he came and picked me up and let me live with him. I ended up leaving, because it wasn't necessarily that much of a happy time in my life, but for 3 or 4 years, like, you know, I had a two-parent household with my biological father, and I didn't have to worry about money and, you know, where the meals are coming from and if he was going to be home. So that stability really impressed upon me. There's my grandfather, who's the most consistent father figure that I've had all of my life. I mean, he's still around.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. So Big Chris, your father, was also in, you know, the life. You know,
lifelong hustler.
Yeah, lifelong hustler. And I'm just trying to figure out how to, like, you know, explain to, like, what is hustler mean? Because you take a lot of time in the latter part of the book breaking down the idea of the hustler and how that, you know, connects to economics and capitalism.
Yeah.
And I thought that was brilliant as well. So, talk to me about, you know, Big Chris and how the ideas of hustling influenced, you know, you and how you ultimately kind of moved in your young adulthood.
Yeah. So, He was a pimp when I was young, and really like caught into the culture of it. So he spoke like it, he dressed like it, he had a Jerry Curl, we had Cadillacs, and since I didn't see, I wasn't around for the kind of fallout. Most of the fallout, I couldn't recognize it. It was kind of, I don't know, alluring is not the right word, but it didn't seem abnormal to me. And maybe that's also mm-hmm. because all of his friends were doing the same thing at the same time. So, and then again, you know, he was also very loving to me. And so he almost normalized hustling for me. And then when I got to be in high school and I was kind of curious about selling drugs, I had an uncle who was actually like a drug kingpin in the 70s. And by the time I was in high school, he was actually struggling with addiction. But we still kind of knew about his lore, and he was the one that kind of got us going pretty early with, you know, cooking drugs and kind of giving us these kind of philosophies about how to be successful.
Okay, Mitchell, let's pick this up on the other side of the break. We're okay. talking to Mitchell S. Jackson. Survival Math, Notes on an American, on an All-American Family is his book that dropped in March. Stay with us. Back with the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Robert Goodwin, hosting my guest, author Mitchell S. Jackson, whose book Survival Math, Notes on an All-American Family was released this month to critical acclaim. You're welcome to join this conversation. Call us at 800-838-3760 or email comments and questions to jx@jeffnet.org. So Mitchell, you were breaking down your uncle who was a renowned hustler, and what hustling means and how that affected you.
Yeah. I had an uncle who, you know, he had a heyday, and I caught him after the heyday, but I still recognize that he had some knowledge about how to hustle. And so I listened to him early on, and he gave us this philosophy, the fast 10 beats the slow 20. My brother and I, who are the same age, were trying to hustle, and he was like, listen, man, you can wait out here all day on $20, but while you're doing that, you could have made $10, you know, umpteen times. And, I mean, really, it's a theory of economics, but I think that we don't often think of the hustler as espousing some kind of valuable economic theory. So fast 10, slow 20 is really me thinking about, you know, where did hustle come from, right? So I started to ask myself, like, well, when did we get the first hustlers? And to me, it happened at during Reconstruction or after Manumission, right? So when the enslaved people were set free and then also kind of coerced into different forms of labor and the opportunities were taken, I was like, well, that's when they would have had to start hustling. But then I also later on realized that not everyone is really a hustler, and what we call hustlers is usually something else. So like my uncle, though he had his heyday, for most of his life he's just been trying to cobble a couple of dollars together, and to me that's not really hustling. So I try to distinguish between, you know, someone who's a scrambler, who's always like reacting to forces rather than kind of being proactive, and then there's the a survivalist who just makes enough to kind of stay solvent. And then the last one is a hustler who actually, if you don't have a surfeit and you're not like, if you don't have like a grand kind of plan, then you're not really a hustler. So I actually don't even know that many hustlers. I know a lot of scramblers and survivalists, but to me, the ultimate is a hustler. And then I, you know, kind of think about, well, where does the kind of economic theory of a hustler come from, and how is it connected to American capitalism?
And I think that, you know, it's always interesting when I hear stories of people of color who use the community ethos, if you will, the neighborhood ethos, if you will, to then work in the majority situations, right?
Yeah.
And so how do we use the code or the street, as folks say, to work, you know, in the you know, environment of the square, you know?
And exactly.
You know, and as I was reading your book, that just kept on hitting me over and over and over again, because you tell, you know, you are, if anything, if I could have some license here, you know, you are a product of those meldings, if you will, you know.
Yeah.
So I was really interested in to know how you felt like you used some of those tenets that you learned from folks who were in the life to navigate, you know, for better or worse, you know, the systems that you've been involved in.
Yeah, I mean, I think I read an article a couple weeks ago by a woman named Maria Popova, and it was an article about Wisdom in the Age of the Internet. And in her article, she distinguished between information, knowledge, and wisdom. She said the information was like some basic fact about the world. And then she said that knowledge was understanding how different bits of information fit together to reveal some truth about the world. And then she said that wisdom had a moral component, that it was the application of information worth remembering and the knowledge that matters to understanding not just how the world works, but like how it should work. So it's like you have to be able to envision the world at its highest potentiality. And I think I was really interested in taking the information that I had, you know, so the facts about my life, and trying to, you know, come up with some kind of correlation between one world, which are kind of this academic or, you know, non-criminalized world, and then these lessons that I learned. And ultimately, it was like in pursuit of some kind of wisdom, right? So like if I could put these two things together, maybe I could arrive at something that was approaching wisdom.
That's interesting, because there's a part that you write in Survival Math about having, and you also say this in the residue years, Doc, that you had to go then through what you had to go through in order to achieve some, you know, wisdom, in order to be the writer you are and the person you are. You know, it could be inferred. But what was the bridge? Like, I know how it is to be impressed upon, like, my folks, you know, were, you know, Black nationalists.
Okay.
So it would have been very hard for me not to be impressed by, you know, that philosophy and practice in terms of how I'd been oriented in the world. How did that work with you? You really talk about that in really very, very focused language, you know, in the book, you know, because you were an athlete, you know, you were very, very, you know, good in school. You also then had the effects of the environment and family with this particular philosophy that then made you make another choice.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, I think what I was never committed. So I knew about these worlds, you know, I never committed to being like the best student. But I knew that I was smart enough to get good grades. I never committed to, you know, being a drug dealer. I never even flirted with gangs. And so I guess it was me all along not really understanding my identity and what I wanted to become. But that also protected me in a sense, because I didn't make those commitments. And I don't even know if I would have wanted, or think it even would have been better if had I committed just completely to school, because I think you kind of lose. I could have been like very book smart and then lost the survival tactics that I needed in the neighborhood. I'm definitely, you know, I'm very much a product of the philosophies of my uncle, of my father. I think that's most evident in the essay, The Scale, which I write about my relationships to women. And so, you know, I've caused a lot of harm in my intimate relationships with women, and it was like me trying to reckon with it and also trying to figure out where those pathologies came from, and also kind of, you know, taking stock of the harms that I've caused. And, you know, you don't want to scapegoat anything. Like, I'm an adult. I have free will. But then also I can't disconnect the way that I have viewed women from, you know, the lessons that I learned from my father and even the observations that I made from my father and my uncles and my cousins and my friends. So I feel, you know, I'm like, I know that I'm of it, but I'm also better than it. I think, and I have to be able to maintain that paradox in myself. You know, I'm from it, but I'm then like, I'm also like beside it.
Right, right, right. I think that that's the interesting dichotomy that jumps off the page in the book, is that, you know, there's no way that the one's actions plus their influences and rearing can, you know, be extricated for themselves from themselves.
Yeah.
But you have the opportunity, which you get, to do something about it. And I would love to get to that place. I want to touch this, you know, this idea of, you know, you spend a lot of time dealing with, like, you know, how, you know, I'm going to say, you know, the pimp manifested in, you know, how you dealt with women. But it seems to be about, like, vulnerability.
Yeah.
You know, and again, identity, you know, which is something that I think, you know, all men, but most definitely Black men, have the challenge of, like, leaning into to learn how to develop, you know, who they know themselves to be with all of the, you know, the challenges of the given circumstances. You do have a letter at the end to your daughter. What have you learned? What did you learn throughout? It sounds like that was, to me, it sounded like, and I think you say this, that was in your 20s, into your 30s. What was that? You know, how did, because there were a lot of things going on with you during that time.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, I think one thing that I realized, what I learned, is how much writing gave me a sense of purpose and how much my achievement in writing helped me to kind of, to use your word, extricate myself from needing these kind of harmful identities to fill in where I was, where I had a dearth. And so I think, you know, having the purpose is very important. Like, I was kind of floating through my 20s. Am I going to do this? Am I going to go play overseas? Am I going to end up at UPS or whatever it is? And then, you know, I figured out writing was it, and I just had to commit to that. So writing is probably the first thing that I fully committed to. And that gave me the purpose that I needed. So I think it's very easy to kind of, you know, fall into these, like, really what are traps of, you know, masculinity, identity, if you don't really have another thing going, you know? And so, I think that's the thing that I most learned, is that, like, man, writing really gave me a sense of purpose and really helped me to kind of make better decisions in my life. And also, even when I was making the bad decisions, because I was writing, I was also reflecting on them in a way that I don't think the average person has to do. You know, like, if you're going to write about in the kind of personal stuff I do, like, I just don't think that the average person is out there writing all of their kind of insecurities, anxieties down and then revising them and then asking those questions of, like, why did you need to make this revision? So it really worked out for me. I also realized that vulnerability might be my greatest strength, which I know that I didn't think that when I was young. And having a daughter absolutely contributed to that, you know, giving over to, you know, committing to loving someone also really helped with that. But I used to think, like, man, that's some weak stuff. But, you know, now I'm like, oh, well, no, it's actually my greatest strength.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that that's the development and maturity of manhood, is when you find out that loving is the greatest strength that we have to offer. You just talked about the, you know, one of the, you know, the, I believe one of the strongest metaphors and, like, actually actualities that you kind of offer in the book. And that's that portion of the book that talks about revision.
Yeah.
You know, like, I love how you start that you know, chapter, which is like, no way in hell, or something. I'm paraphrasing that you wouldn't, you know, you would start, you know, your interaction with your students with us, you know, saying that you got to revise.
Yeah.
So how do you break that down? You know, not only, I mean, how can you tell how you break that down in the book and offer it?
Yeah. So I'm always trying to figure out how a kind of philosophy that I use on a page, like, figures into my life, or versa, how my life figures into the philosophies that I use for the page. And so one of the revision techniques is actually something that I learned from a guy I studied with years ago, but it's called recursion. And that is you look back to inform where to go next, right?
Okay.
So you look
back.
Mitchell,
we
got
a minute. Left.
Okay.
I want you to get this in. I don't want to be interrupt you this time.
Okay.
So I'm like,
all right.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, we got a minute. Okay, so
yeah.
So revision is that you can take the kind of tools you use for revising on a page and apply them to a life. And the essay is about me imagining what outcomes my dead friends that were murdered very young would have had they been given a certain revision philosophy that I use on the page. And I think ultimately that's something that I value in the world, right? That I'm always looking back to figure out, inform, where am I going to go next?
Okay. Yeah. And I think that's the greatest with a few minutes. I'm going to take the weight on this with a few minutes left, with a few seconds left. That's the strength of offering that as a model, that you have the ability to look at it and continue to refine and refine and refine.
Yeah.
Man, it was a pleasure reading your work and talking to you. Survival Math, Notes on an All-American Family by Mitchell S. Jackson. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, man. I appreciate this.